'tis essential to look carefully into the process which was gone through when the holy ones of the past realized the supreme spiritual beatitude. In theistic terms, it is called union with God. In Buddhist terms, it is called the realization of nirvana. The Upanishads presented it in the dual form, realizing the Atma, or the affirmation that I am Brahman. Now it is very important to appreciate the fact that the term Atma, the phrase I am Brahman, represents a state, a transcendent state of awareness being, hyphenating the two words, of that awareness which is identical with being, in other words. It is that realization which was the peak point of all spiritual attainment. So that in the texts we find Atma as well as Brahman spoken of as a state of consciousness. Consciousness is not too good a word, because consciousness as such is discriminative consciousness. And it is for that reason that I prefer to use the term awareness, and particularly to use the double-barreled term awareness being. Now, what was the process by which this awareness being was realized, that is, made real? When the sense activities quieten down, when they are pacified, when all discursive intellectual activity similarly quietens down until it becomes quite still, one is able to enter into a state of awareness which is quite different from the awareness which we ordinarily experience in everyday life. In everyday life, it is I, the subject, who am conscious of you, or that thing, or this event as the object. There is a separation. There is always an analytical perception, a perception which recognizes that which the person already has known before and come across before. It may be to a certain extent new, but it is new only in the sense that it is a modification, an extension, a slight alteration of that which went before. Otherwise, recognition is not possible. The very first cognition means, well, you don't know what you are seeing or hearing. It's completely new. Now, all this is expressed in words. And words stand for whatsoever is finite and particular, for whatsoever begins, proceeds, and dies, belongs to the realm of the mortal. And it is in this manner that we are ordinarily aware in everyday life. Now when this completely quietens down and we enter into the silence, as we call it, we are not aware in words and thoughts. How are we aware? We cease to be aware in terms of particularity, of limitation. We cease to be aware in mortal terms. We are entering into that state of awareness which is a realizing of non-mortality or immortality. Now obviously this cannot be known by us with our sense perception and our brain, which is only aware and active in terms of separation, of limitation, of mortality. So immortality cannot be known or experienced in that sense. But it suffuses this individual awareness, which is growing into that new condition, that new dimension of being and consciousness. It is outgrowing this mortal condition. Now, in this process, the various ideas which we have, the perceptions which we have in the ordinary sense, all the knowledge that we have, all drops off. And it drops off because it gets negated, denied by this profounder, immortal awareness. This is entering into what is truly the spiritual state, which is your state. It doesn't mean that the spiritual world is another world apart from the total world as it is. But it is your own state which has altered, your own state of awareness. Now the very important point to bear in mind is this negating, this rejecting, without throwing it away, but by outgrowing all that we know here, all that we believe, that we have experienced, that we are convinced is true in our ordinary sense, brain, consciousness. It is a negation of it all. It is a putting aside of all that. It is as the mystics of the world, Christian or Sufi or Hindu or any other mystics have put it. It is a process by which the soul is stripped of everything. It has to stand naked before her Lord in order that that supreme consummation may be realized. You see? This is very important. All this which is within the mind, all the images, all the firm beliefs, the convictions, everything disappears. And it disappears because it is outgrown. And in that outgrowing, it is negated. That is not true in the face of this transcendent reality, this transcendent truth. And so the ultimate state which those holy ones arrived at was this state where self, functioning as self-consciousness, had completely disappeared. It wasn't even a case of Thou, O Lord, and I. There was only the one undifferenced, undifferentiated, ultimate reality. Call it by the personalistic term God or Ahura Mazda or Allah. Call it by the non-personalistic term Atma or Brahman or Nirvana. Call it by any name you will. But it is your state when all that we know here all that belongs to the realm of mortality, meaning beginning, proceeding, and ending, is completely out. That is the infinite, the immeasurable. That is the absolute. That is the state or condition or whatever word you like to use, with which one can have no dealing whatsoever. That's the phrase used in the Mandukya Upanishad, and it's a wonderful phrase, a most telling and revealing phrase. You can have no dealing whatsoever with God, with the ultimate, with the absolute. Now, that is the state which is referred to when the scriptures use the term in the beginning. The phrase in the beginning does not mean time at all. It has nothing to do with time. It has nothing to do with something outside me, the person, or you, the person. When you have realized and are in that state of awareness which is identical with being, your psychical being is in that state. That is the state referred to as in the beginning. I'm using the term in the beginning because you find it both in the Upanishads and in Genesis. In the case of Genesis, it is actually a mistranslation. Bereshit, which is translated as in the beginning, really means out of the unknown origin. And not only unknown, but unknowable. Now, if it is the unknowable, if it is the unknown, outside me, myself, outside you, yourself, how could the writer ever have written it? That is the point. But it is not outside you, yourself, nor is it inside you, yourself. And yet, because there is a living organism, the you, yourself, which has so quietened down that in terms of this profoundest consciousness, totality is realized. Therefore, you, when you come back to normal consciousness, describe that as in the beginning. And there is a reason why you may describe it as in the beginning. Better still, say out of the unknown origin. Because that state is the indescribable, the unanalyzable, the non-perceivable, the impossible to feel out. It is only afterwards that the brain constructs a system of thought and speech to try and suggest that unspeakable beatitude. That is all. Now they've called it in the beginning because after a time there is a return journey back to one's ordinary state. This return journey must of necessity take place because there is a living body, a physical body which has natural functions, which can be suspended for, if you like, 4, 5, 7 days, but not more. So there has to be a return back to ordinary sense and brain functioning and the movement of the body and so forth. You see? Now, how does this return journey take place? As one awakens, actually one goes to sleep in fact, coming back to the physical world, if you like, you see? As one returns to this state here, one by one, impressions arise by virtue of the impact of that which exists upon one's own mind. Differentiation starts again. Remember, in the first part, the journey into the transcendent, differentiation disappears. Now differentiation starts again. And so pictures arise in the mind. Concepts re-arise. And so forth. Now the primary distinction which is made is between the conscious and the unconscious. Between that which is nominated transcendent and that which is nominated the non-transcendent. That world and this world. So in Genesis we have the Elohim made the heaven, which is the transcendent, that, and this, the earth. Between that which is not within the grasp of discriminative consciousness, I'm using a long phrase, a long sentence, Jung would just lump it as unconsciousness, you see, and consciousness, earth, that which you are conscious of. And step by step, the whole statement gets made, and it is called the creation of the world. It has nothing to do with the creation of the world. That first chapter of Genesis tells you what happens to your psyche as you return from the state of transcendent consciousness. So, in Genesis, in the beginning was that, out of the unknown origin, as I say, is the truer translation, and then all this world as such. The impact of the world as it is upon my personal, individual consciousness and mind. Now, in which way will I express that impact? I can only express it in terms of the mental material which is already there. I have no option in the matter. You will find that as far as the type is concerned, it is identically the same in all the great religions regarding the creation of the world. But where the formulation, the particular picturization is concerned, it is different. And the difference, you can see, is due to the particular environment, the socio-cultural heritage of the people to whom the Holy One belongs. We can't escape that. That is the material we have. If you are in certain countries, you have only the palm leaves and some bamboos which you can stick together and make your house. If you are here, you have bricks and other things and you make your house. In both cases, it is a house. But the difference in the houses is due to the available material. It's like that. Now, the important thing to bear in mind is this, that this which is called the creation of the world is the imaging in my mind and nothing else. They are all the images in my mind, the result of the actual impact of the world as it is in itself upon my sense perceptions. Now that raises up a very important point. I, as I am, do not know and never can know here and now the truth. It's totally impossible. What I do know, and when I say I know this or I know the other, all I am saying is that I am acquainted with the images in my mind, the impressions in my mind, which I express in such and such words. But the thing in itself I am ignorant of. Here and now, as I am. And in that transcendent state, things in themselves as separate things are no more. And therefore, in either state, I can never know particular things in themselves. And why are things no more in that transcendent state? Because the transcendent state is the state where discriminative consciousness having ceased to function, you are aware only of totality. And totality is one totality. You are aware of one only. The only one, if you like to put it that way. And because of that, there is no differentiation. But you see the tremendous consequences. We have sort of been taught about these things, we have read about these things, we have thought about these things, in an inadequate, in a distorted way. We haven't seen that what is called the creation of the world in the scriptures, all the descriptions, all the accounts, have nothing to do with the actual galaxies and solar systems and suns and stars and planets and stones and earth and plants and animals and insects and you and me. Nothing to do with that at all. This is the fact. That which is postulated as God, that which is postulated as the supreme power, etc., the unknown, the holy of holies and all the rest of it, has nothing to do with the creation of the world in itself. Nothing at all. The world is there. I do not know it. I never can know it. Just as if I were to postulate that there is this absolute supreme God who created it, I can never know anything about that. What I do know is the state I have realized myself by living the holy life, by meditation and prayer, as we call it, till I reach that stage where all differentiation has vanished, the self has vanished, as a separate self, and only the awareness of totality is present. That I can know. You see? So that all this is the imaging in my mind. The grasping by discriminative consciousness. This is the meaning of the statement that the Atma or Brahman becomes all this. It's not that the Atma becomes the chairs and the tables and the moons and the rocks and the metals and whatnot. Not a bit of it. It's not that the Atma becomes that. Atma represents this state of awareness. But this state of awareness becomes all this descriptive mental imaging in my mind, which is my world. That is to say, the world as it is apprehended by me in my mind. Is that quite clear? Otherwise, you know, if we don't see this clearly, we set our sights wrongly. We try to pursue a God or a Nirvana or a Brahman somewhere in the distance. The pie in the sky business comes in. But this way you see clearly that there is no pie in the sky. Religion deals at its heart with one's own awareness. It's the story of the fruition of consciousness, of discriminative consciousness, into that transcendent beatitude of non-discriminative awareness. That is what religion is about. Very good. Now, this imaging in the mind is illusory. The image in my mind of the moon, or the chair, or the lamp, or the person, or the dog, or the whatever it is, the image in my mind is only a picture. And it is almost never a true picture. It is a partial picture. It's a distorted picture. Somewhat like the work of certain people who will call themselves artists. You see? And so forth. It is that sort of picture. Now, why is it that sort of picture? It's important to know this. Discriminative consciousness, vijnana as the Buddhists put it, discriminative consciousness is a characteristic activity of the living psychophysical organism. This psychophysical organism, with its animal evolution, has its inherent heritage of fear, aggressiveness, greed, hate, resentment, ill will, malice, delusion, illusion, ignorance, all the rest of it. Discriminative consciousness is unable to see exactly what the thing is because of the operation of all these factors in us. That is why the Buddha said, all this is ill. Now you see why it is ill. The exquisite perfume of a rose, the wonderful loveliness of a sunset or something like that, is not ill. Nor is it well. It is. That is all. The illness is my picture of it, which is tainted with possessiveness, with greed, with desire. With that in my nature, which will hurt it, harm it, distort it, spoil it, which will ravish it. You see? And we have the same attitude with respect to all the sublime and the beautiful and the wonderful things. All the people who so love God that they will this, that and the other are attempting to ravish God. They won't leave him alone. This is the ill state. If God is the omnipotent, if God is the absolute majesty, then who am I to interpose, to obtrude this terrible thing, this conflicting, confused, distorted thing upon that divine presence? The lovers of God have to beware. Similarly, the lovers of truth, the lovers of love, these are the images in the mind, and they are all tainted, all tainted. That is why all this which manifests in the mind, which appears as the whole set of images in the mind, is tainted at the source. Therefore, the purification means letting it go. When discriminative consciousness learns to observe without clinging to anything whatsoever under any conditions, then it is beginning to observe purely. But if it is going to observe in that manner, the individual cannot hold beliefs, convictions, ideals, good intentions, and all the rest of it. Because they are all distorted pictures in the mind. It is not I who effect the purification, the perfecting. It is this unknown, eternal, wonderful mystery which does it. I have to keep quiet. This is what none of us can do. So now, the return journey back to ordinary consciousness once again fills the mind with the images. Out come the theologies and the philosophies and all the rest of it as a consequence. But if one has oneself, at least in sufficient measure, and that sufficient measure is a tremendous measure, believe me, if in sufficient measure one has made that journey, the emergence into the Absolute, and the emergence back out of it into the ordinary differentiated condition, if one has made that journey, then one knows and can perhaps help others to beware that all this which is presented, formally presented, formally, in thoughts and in words, is only a picture intended to be a crutch, to help a little bit. But you see, we take that picture as truth. This is the truth. And then I say, I believe absolutely this, that, and the other. And so the mistake comes. Now we will see why the discipline of the holy life is this non-clinging, non-grasping, letting go. In other words, to let the stream of life flow unhindered, not to be an obstruction to that stream. And in this process, obviously, the quality of harmlessness, the quality of patience, peaceableness, the quality of gentle endurance of all that comes in the flowing of this river of life, play their part. We must not try to impose the quality on life. We must just be very quiet. Be very quiet and entirely open, entirely vulnerable, so to say, to life. And now, a better word than vulnerable seems to me entirely impressionable to life in its purity. Then we won't get false pictures. Entirely impressionable to life in its purity, which means discriminative consciousness is being able to be free of the forces of greed, delusion, hate, and so forth. Thank you. Consider now certain tremendous implications of all this. We live imprisoned by our ideas, ideals, and our beliefs. The beliefs are the doctrines which we hold and so forth. Take two of the teachings for which India is very responsible, a rebirth and what they call karma. Much has been written and presented about karma, the justice of God, the equilibrating process through the world, the rewards and punishments which inevitably come to us and to others as a result of thought and deed and so forth. Take all those ideas which have been presented about karma. The word karma is derived from the root kri, meaning to act, or still more deeply, to create. And the word kriya, which means a ritual, a ceremonial ritual, originally meant a ritual which worked as a creative magic. This was the original idea. Now, to create. But creation has no consequences to it in our sense of the word consequence. Creation is a free act. No one can either give a reward or punish or criticize or approve creation. Creation has an absoluteness about it. You say, God the Creator. Are we going to mete out approval or disapproval to God? Punishment or reward to the Absolute? Can we do it? It's totally impossible, is it not? But now, all action in its pure state is creation. And all action in its pure state is totally of the nature of harmony. It is only when disturbing activities creep up that we get the confused state, the conflicting state, the pleasure-pain state, the necessity, the desire to adjust condition, and so forth. And what are the factors involved in our understanding of this part of the story, our action? And remember, thought is mental action. Speech is verbal action. And the deed, the physical deed, is physical action. It is all action. Our ordinary conditioned life, our barter system on which we live, plays the dominant part in our presentation of what we call the law of karma. The law of karma has been hopelessly misrepresented through the ages. Hopelessly misrepresented. We talk of it as cause and effect, as if cause and effect were two separate things, only related to each other, as if in terms of impact. You see, for instance, if this book is standing there like that, and then I push it down like that, well, one says that the cause because of which the book fell down was the push which I gave to it, and the effect was the falling down. Now, of course, in this limited context of two objects which are cognized by us and of which we are conscious in terms of separate objects, it is relatively true, quite true, to say, yes, I pushed the book, therefore the book fell down, cause and effect. Now this is taken over and transferred into the whole realm of karma. Or again, if I have goods in a shop and a man comes, wants this bit of goods or that bit of goods, I say, right, you give me this much money for this, you can have this, and give me this money and you can have that. Or if a person makes a contract with me and I break the contract, he can take me to court and have me punished for it, or restitution can be made. Now this idea of restitution, reward, punishment and all the rest of it springs out of our ordinary everyday life, and we plaster it on to the teaching of karma on the grand scale, which essentially is creative action. Now this aspect of our ordinary life more or less works in practice. Separate objects, separate people can be taken and one can make adjustments and so forth. But now consider something else. In any living process, how are you going to apportion out precisely cause-effect? I breathe in certain quantity of air. The air goes inside and performs a certain action, and I breathe out and the same old nitrogen and a little bit of extra carbon dioxide and part of the oxygen, they all come out again. But as a result of the breathing in, a whole lot of operations go on. But they all go on as an integrated whole. Where am I going to separate out this was the precise cause, that was the precise effect? And how am I going to balance it up, 20 shillings for the pound note style? It's totally impossible. But the ordinary conception of karma is just that. The 20 shillings for the pound note fashion procedure, this equilibrating, as man knows equilibrating, is called karma, and it is applied to the universal process, which just isn't true. It's transferred into the moral sphere. Your sinner is punished, your saint is blessed. All right. My friend the saint and I the sinner were walking along together one day, and we were so busy talking that we fell over the 2,000-foot precipice. The same thing happened to us at the bottom. I wasn't spared because I was a sinner, and he wasn't spared because he was a saint. I wasn't punished because I was a sinner. He wasn't punished because he was a saint. It just happened. That's the process as a whole. This is what we must see. Then again, a riot breaks out in the street. we are totally innocent people, if we just happen to open the front door and look out and see what's happening here, you see. And somebody throws a petrol bomb and it falls upon the lot of us. Now just precisely what are the sins that we have committed for which we are punished by that petrol bomb? Can you apportion it out? Complete nonsense, isn't it? Then people ask, well, is there no justice then in the process? But what do I mean by justice? This petty little conception for which I am responsible in terms of the limited context of human relationships in my society with my neighbor, it just doesn't work that way. Supposing this great galaxy of ours got a little bit too curious about the appearance of the next galaxy and went too close, well, there'd be a marvelous explosion. The whole lot of us would go out. What about the law of karma now? Now, we come to ourselves. We are postulated as immortal entities who are climbing a ladder to perfection, spiritual realization. It's in the divine plan that we shall all become angels and archangels and gods and whatnot, or perfected creatures of some sort, and all of us will reach nirvana and goodness knows what. All this is postulated. Well, of course you can't do it in one lifetime, you know. It's such a marvelous task that it must of necessity take many lifetimes. So having postulated one thing unwarrantably, we have to postulate 10, 100, 1,000 other things equally unwarrantably. Why do we swallow it? Because we like it. It gives us a pleasurable sensation to feel that, it's a nice world, it will all come out right in the end, God's grace, God's goodness and all the rest of it. We know nothing about it. What I do know is that I don't know. And all that I postulate is tainted with falsity and ignorance from beginning to end. Now you know, it takes a brain of love and a heart of wisdom and knowledge, I'm going to put it that way around, in order really to let all of this go and just be. Life lives through this. I don't do anything. It is the eternal reality, the totality, which is functioning through this, and all that I, the self-conscious, the discriminatively self-conscious individual I'm doing is obstructing this process. So I invent all this system of lives and so forth and so forth. Now, if I let go this idea of karma, for instance, and that is to say, my human conceptions of karma, there are tremendous consequences to this. We live here and now from moment to moment. There is nothing that persists. If you want to lay your finger upon something which is you yourself or I myself, which is the unchanging thing in us, perhaps the brain is about the best example. Within the lifetime of the body, the brain cells remain, don't they? Those which die are not replaced. So, the same brain cells with which I started when my brain did sort of grow to its full size and become mature, you see, are the cells which continue through my lifetime. All the rest changes. It's true that the atoms inside the brain must necessarily undergo alteration because of oxygen supply and sugar and all the rest of it. But the cells as cells do not undergo fission, do not undergo change. Right? Very good. But that is just for this lifetime. And that is the perhaps the most real me, the most distinctive me, my brain box and my brain cells. Everything else changes. Everything else is ephemeral. Nothing which I can say, this is absolutely mine, the unchanging property which is me. Therefore, when this disappears, this me and the self-consciousness of I am I, which it has out of illusion, out of delusion, abstracted out of its own existence, that disappears with it at death, completely and utterly. Just as the self-consciousness of I am I disappears temporarily when you're asleep. You don't know you are you. You have no self-responsibility at all. You're just blotto. Isn't that so? How does that self-consciousness start up again next day when you're once the vigilance center somewhere here in the cerebellum region begins to be active, and then the memory of everything comes back again, and you are again able to assert, I am I. But as long as the brain is there, you can assert, I am I. And when that brain has gone forever and ever, the I am I, who is myself, John Smith or Firoz Mehta or Mary Brown or whoever it is out forever. Make no mistake about it. Now, if that is the case, and it seems to me very much that that is the fact of our existence, then a terrible thing, a terrible problem faces us. Those who suffer, those who are ill-treated, those who are born like the Thalidomide children, or blind, or deaf, or who have to suffer in life. We cannot explain it away with this false explanation of, oh, it's your past karma, endure it patiently and nobly. In your next life, you'll have a nice house and a nice wife, and everything will go nicely. It's all nonsense. The rascal, the villain, makes a heap of money, we'll say, and enjoys a jolly good time, and then suddenly one day he has a heart attack and is laughing his sides out with pleasure, and he dies, and that's the end of him. Justice, we'll say, where is the justice of it all? None whatsoever, according to our human conceptions of justice. There is no putting it right. There is no compensation in a future, in a mythical future, for Auschwitz and Belsen and all those who have suffered untold horror. There is nothing going to which will compensate you for what you have endured. Nothing whatsoever. Therefore, if we see that is the fact of the process of existence in the world as such, that is the fact of the process, then it lays upon us a titanic responsibility. The only thing we can do is to live here now, from moment to moment, completely and absolutely in terms of love, of wisdom, of truth, of purity. We can never escape that. One has to have a godly vision, a divine vision, to see the fact of the universal process to see how everything gets imaged in our mind and is the source of delusion and illusion. To let it all go, to look for nothing for ourselves or for others, but to live from moment to moment, absolutely in terms of love, wisdom, truth, purity, and so on. This is what lies in practice, in actual action, at the heart of religion. Our morality, our ethic, has to have no truck with this sloppy relative ethic of the world. But it has to be a transcendental ethic, an absolute goodness under all and any circumstances, because there is nothing else that I can possibly do. I can never put it right for him who has suffered. I'd be wasting my time looking for a day when some wonderful deity or some beneficent power will wipe away the tears and put it all right for everybody's suffering. Not at all. That's finished once and for all. It's gone. Therefore, and who was responsible for my neighbor suffering and crying but I? It is because I think, feel, hate, because I'm aware and live in terms of selfness enclosed, that I'm cruel, that I'm stupid, and all the rest of it. So you see, if there is the religious vision, this vision, this opening out into the transcendent reality of everything, then there is nothing else that can possibly be attempted even, but to live now in terms of absolute love and truth and purity. Which again will mean the purity of the mind also. And the purity of the mind means no grasping at beliefs, ideas, no grasping at any and every single mental construct which clutters my brain. Is this too austere? Never mind if it's too austere or not too austere. Do we feel that this perhaps is nearer the heart of truth?
It's grim reality, isn't it? Grim reality.
Grim reality. But look, George, when you really see that, yes, this is getting at the heart of reality, you see, the grimness disappears. And nothing else is substituted in its place, pleasurable or pleasant or beautiful or anything. No. Reality is reality. All the adjectives are my weakness, not my strength. Comfort and comforting is the power of infinite resilience.
And yet the Buddha talked in terms of rebirth.
So they say. Is it true? Look, Dick, look. I'm glad you raised that point. Not only the Buddha, because that deals just with Buddhism, but all the all the philosophies of Hinduism also put out this idea of rebirth. What is the real meaning underlying rebirth? Let me start at the positive end. The Upanishads, which are the quintessence of Brahmanical wisdom and realization, mind you, they talked out of realization. They used the word samsara to start with, didn't they? Samsara. Now, samsara means the world process. That is its first meaning. The world process is samsara. Now, this world process goes on by itself. It went on by itself before I was born. It goes on whilst I'm alive. It goes on after this fellow is dead, doesn't it? So the world process exists on its own. Now this world process, whilst I, a person, am living in it, is apprehended by my discriminative consciousness. You see? It's apprehended. And because this apprehension, as I pointed out earlier, is tainted with greed, hate and delusion, this apprehension of samsara is dukkha. It is not that the world process is dukkha. There is no dukkha in the fact that the earth rotates on its own axis quite regularly and beautifully and revolves around the sun once every year quite beautifully and regularly. That is not dukkha at all. Is the exquisiteness of the rose dukkha? You don't call that dukkha. All this is part of the world process. But it is my apprehension of the world process, when tainted with grasping, etc., etc., you see, then that is the dukkha that is spoken of. Now, so when that grasping and all the taints are out, this same samsara is apprehended as nirvana. What else is nirvana? I mean, look at your prajnaparamita carefully. See? Nirvana. Now the prajnaparamita puts it this way, that nirvana is not different from samsara, and samsara is given the specialized meaning of birth's death. This is rather a pity. Instead of giving it the specialized meaning of birth-death, it would have been more inclusive and nearer the reality, the truth of the matter, if it was left as the world process. Very good. Now, my apprehension of this world process cannot be a total apprehension of the total world process all the time. No single human mind can possibly do that. You see? So I apprehend this particular thing in which I'm interested. I go through the experience, I come to the end of it. You see? I apprehend the next thing, go through the process and come to the end of it. And I identify myself, this mysterious I am I, with every single apprehension. This is my cycle of births and deaths in consciousness. You see, because I, by association, am born at that moment of identification, and I lose my identification with it when the thing is over. This is a real meaning of rebirth, if you like. See? All right. Now, you might say, but oh, this is your own interpretation. The teachers taught differently. Did they? Look at the Maitri Upanishad. Look at it. Here we are. Samsara is just one's own thought process. There's no mention of what the Theosophists called a reincarnating ego carrying on. There is no mention at all there. with effort, he should cleanse it, this thought process. What is one's thought, that he becomes. This is the eternal mystery. There's no need to say eternal mystery, really. What is one's thought, that he becomes. As I said, by self-identification. You identify yourself with the thing of which you are conscious. You see? The mind is said to be twofold, the pure and also the impure. Impure by union with desire, pure from desire completely free. By making mind all motionless, the thing with which we started this afternoon, complete stillness, silence, by making mind all motionless, from sloth and from distraction free, because in this attempt to make the mind motionless, one can get somnolent and go to sleep. This business in the Garden of Gethsemane, when the disciples fell asleep, they were not free from sloth and from distraction. They fell asleep, they couldn't pray with Jesus, enter into that supreme communion. When unto mindlessness one comes, amanibhavam, mindlessness, which means the non-fluctuating state of the mind. That is the mindless state. There are no thoughts, no ideas, nothing inside. It is just the pure, receptive, responsive sensitivity of the living organism. That's the way I define mind. See, it's just that pure sensitivity, absolutely untarnished, unpolluted by any ideas, etc., etc., and so on, you see. When unto mindlessness one comes, then that is the supreme estate. All right. Samsara is just one's own thought. Here, a little more specifically. Shandilya Upanishad. You see, these are the so-called well-known Upanishads, but these are the real important ones, because here you get all the secrets let out. And it's very difficult to get this book, unless of course you buy the original Sanskrit, if you have to know Sanskrit to understand that. The teacher answers, O Prince of Sages, he calls his disciple, yoga, he uses the word repression in translation, this is bad, but since it is here, I'll read. Yoga is the repression of the modifications of the mind, and jnana, knowledge, is the thorough inquiry into the modifications of the mind. When the modifications of the mind are repressed, the mind verily obtains peace. Just as the actions of people cease with the stopping of the changes of the sun, that is, with sunset, people go to sleep, you see? So, now listen, when the fluctuations of the mind cease, this cycle of births and deaths comes to an end. These yoga Upanishads put it perfectly clear that the cycle of births and deaths is the process which goes on in the mind of the living person. There is no mention, and certainly not in the Rig Veda, of any entity which continues life after life. No such mention at all. This doctrine was invented later on And it proved an extremely convenient doctrine in managing the kingdoms and preserving law and order. Just as the theistic religions invented heaven and hell and the bait of reward in heaven and the threat of punishment in hell, and it was a great force to keep the people quiet, and otherwise they'd never have maintained law and order. Not that we maintain it any better today, but there we are. So now, the fluctuations of the mind, this is the real rebirth. Birth, death, you see. Consider the actual word, for example, used in the Buddhist text, since you mentioned the Buddha. Jati. The word jati simply means appearance. An appearance. There is an appearance. And as you know very well from the Buddhist analysis, such and such being the forces at play, such and such an appearance is there, present. So, you see? And in the Visuddhimagga, look at Nyanamoli's translation of the Visuddhimagga, where the reincarnational concept is absolutely wiped out in just so many words. You see? So you have to be very careful in understanding this thing, which the Buddhists call punarbhava, again becoming. But the again becoming is not a disjointed, separate something. You see? It is this thing undergoing transformation, and a little later it appears as that thing. But it is the same thing undergoing change. This is the punarbhava. It is a way of expressing what we in modern science call the law of conservation of energy and mass. It just undergoes transformation of appearance all the time. The nature of the appearance and the nature of the experiences depend upon the qualities at play, and so forth. See? But there is no indication whatsoever that an entity, some mysterious entity here, after the death of the body as such, gets transferred over into another living body. Living bodies emerge from each other by a continuous process. That is all. But we cling to this because we want a reward. If we are completely free of wanting a reward, if we are completely free of the passion to achieve something, to attain a goal, which is all selfness, selfishness, if we are really free from that, will be free from this misconception of punarbhava. It is an emergent process. Professor Lloyd Morgan's philosophy of emergent evolution in some ways is a good presentation of what they meant by punarbhava. Now, it was the Hindus particularly who introduced the punarjanma. They had no reincarnation in the Rig Veda, but once the Aryan kingdoms were established, and the rulers were in the minority, and the majority were the ordinary people, and they started asking questions. Well, why are we in this condition, and you are lords and masters and enjoying and this and that? Then the Brahmin priests took over the beliefs of the primitive proto-Australoid and Negrito peoples of India. They are primitive beliefs that an indestructible life essence, soul matter, at death went into the soil, emerged in plants, and when a pregnant woman ate of that, it entered into the fetus. And so that paved the way for the entity incarnating again and again belief. You see? That is how it happened. But you think of it. An entity has meaning only in terms of physical existence. As physical existence, we have an entity, because we have very powerful electrical forces which produce the cohesion of matter in such a way that when a living person's senses are impressed with stimuli from there, he interprets it, interprets that as a separate thing. So the entity concept comes. But the entity concept, which applies in this physical concept, context, cannot be applied to the psychical context. You see the extraordinary confusion that we go through. And all these so-called lives of the Buddha. Now if you look carefully, the Buddha, this is attributed to the Buddha himself, and I believe this is perfectly legitimate and true. The Buddha says, time and again, and then he entered into the second jhana, third jhana, fourth jhana. Now what are the characteristics of that fourth jhana? That complete equanimity of mind, in which there is the total disappearance of all joy and sorrow. Don't forget that. Which implies also the complete disappearance of all grasping, of all desire to attain this, that or the other. And then he says, he bent his mind to the investigation of his Buddha Nivasa, former habitations. You see, former habitations. And he looked back, and what is stated about these wonderful former habitations? That he ate such and such food, that he had such and such a dress, you see, and so forth. That's just a few words like that which sound almost silly. And these are states which go back literally into tens of millions and so forth. But if we interpret them as separate incarnations, that will imply a time span of several hundreds of millions of years, but life itself on the planet has not existed for longer than 350 million years. How are you going to fit it in? Obviously this is not the meaning. I'll tell you what I think about it, if you like. These Buddha Nivasa are the states of mind from moment to moment backwards. In a single day, how many states of mind do I go through? The fluctuations of the mind, as the Upanishads put it. This is what even modern psychology knows about. You know, the association technique by which you recall, oh, just previous to that, associated with that, associated with that, associated with that. And you see the way the forces within the psyche have worked to produce these different states of mind. Now this is precisely what the Buddha saw. That is why he was such a master of the mind. When the Buddha said, omniscient am I, what was he omniscient about? Algebra, chemistry, physics, cosmology, astronomy, not a bit of it. He didn't know what an ordinary fourth form schoolboy knows today. He was omniscient with regard to the nature of the human mind and what it does. He knew all of that. This is where he was omniscient. So these are the Buddha Nivasa, you see, which showed him conclusively the nature of the mind, how it operates, what are the forces at play, and therefore he presented his Paticca Samuppada to give the mechanism, the rationale of this process of the arising of the world imaged in my mind, which is ill. This is what he did. But do you find this anywhere in the books about Buddhism? I tell you, they don't know it. They're very ignorant about it all. Please don't think that I am frightfully conceited that I know. What I do know is that I don't know. But certain things one can see.
Just to be master of your mind,
Sophia. we would find it very profitable to investigate why the question is asked at all. Why do I ask the question? What is the purpose of my life? In order that, knowing the purpose, I can now fulfill and obtain the desired result. Drop it. Just live. Let life deal with you. Give yourself to life. Give yourself completely, openly, lovingly. Don't care. If life wants to kick you about like a football, let life enjoy itself. If life wants to cuddle you and put you in a palace on a throne, let life do it. Don't ask. Because you see, we shall always be reduced to the levels of littleness with a question like that. What is the purpose of my life? I'm not really concerned with the purpose of anybody else's life, you know. I may pretend to be altruistic that way. What I'm concerned with is me. This is a self-concern, this question. You can propound the question if the mind is so utterly balanced and clean that it can look at it as a subject for investigation. Then one may say that one sees a trend on this planet. I can't say anything more about other planets. I don't think there are fellows on Mars or anywhere else. We are here. There is a certain trend, an evolutionary trend, a movement towards greater sensitization, a movement towards the release of a profounder and a finer capacity for response from within consciously in such a manner that the living human being can cooperate with the nature of the flow of life on this planet. And in that is beauty and loveliness and worthwhileness and all the delight and the zest and the wonder of it. But you have to have a tremendous heart and mind to see and take it like that. There is beauty. See, it's life which is beautiful, not I. But insofar as I do not obstruct life, I am so part and parcel of life that life, the totality, makes this beautiful. I'm using the word beauty and beautiful because I'm talking to a lady. If I was talking to a man, I would say strength. Then these different Jataka stories, and in the discourses too, the Buddha says, now Ananda, it must be realized that I myself was so and so, Yashodhara was so and so, Ananda, you were so and so, etc. In that story. Every religion has its systematic mythology. It's in the form of a story that you can speak to the people who are not university standard. When you get them, you are all graduates, you are all PhDs here. At that stage, good gracious me, we don't want mythology. We want more and more to see the truth as it is. I know somebody will say, but you said that we can never know it. But you carry on. You will never know it here in this form. But you will find that all your verbal formulations, all your mind pictures will become simpler, they will become cleaner, they will become truer, and approach closer and closer as representatives, representors of that, the eternal, the immortal, which cannot be represented. And that is the best I can do.
And most of us then die without having reached anywhere near this
Exactly. Exactly so. Accept the fact. That is why I say, now, this moment, live completely with every energy bent to being completely loving, completely wise. Don't let the mind say, but I'm not at that stage. Of course I'm not at that stage. But let me bend every energy to it from this instant onwards. Yes. That's not the purpose, that's the way. Yes. That is the way, that's what I'm saying. Good Rishan, I've been saying it for some years now. Isn't that so, Dick? Now look, I know this is a very real problem with you. And believe me, I often know what's in people and what's happening to them, even when they are away, in their insides. They are inside the inside of their minds. I know this is a real thing with you. You see? But be happy. Just be happy and go on. At it, boy. And that's all. Don't be concerned with results. Because if you orient your activity in the light of a goal which you in your present state see, you will misorient your life energy. Life will guide you. Look, do you maintain that body? Not a bit of it. The process goes on despite you, despite the self-conscious you. You don't know anything about how the blood flows and the brain works and the lungs work. They just work. The whole thing is an integrated whole. This is life, the mystery, the marvel. And it's the same with the whole of us.
And know? Then before one has achieved anything approaching that one, then the whole thing goes like
this. Oh, there you are, achieved anything like Nirvana. Good God, man. You'll get 1 out of 10. No, Dick, it's not a case of... You know, you will never achieve Nirvana. You, the finite you, Dick Patterson, can never achieve the infinite, immeasurable, incomprehensible Nirvana.
No, I know. You mean that in a way there isn't a you to do it.
Exactly.
Yes.
So all you can do, as I say, is to bend your total energy now to just living the pure, simple, good life. And be sensible. This is very difficult, you know. To be sensible is a rare thing. The Buddha was sensible. Jesus was sensible. Yajnavalkya, Pipalada, son of Kumara, Narada, the whole lot of them, they were sensible. A person becomes fully sensible as is possible to a human being when he has let go, made this journey, or rather this journey just takes place, and that transcendent awareness being is realized through him. It's not that I realize it. The totality realizes it through this because I have ceased to obstruct it with my thoughts, my desires, my ambitions, my strivings, my ideas, my beliefs, and all the rest of it. As I say, I have to strip myself naked completely. That is all. You don't go and have a bath with all your clothes on. You take all your clothes off, and the bath makes you completely clean. Isn't that so? One does the same with the mind and the heart. This clinging to self all the time, these are the subtle forms, these are the delusions. This is what the Buddha meant by delusion.